Where outside the body is your soul today, Melissa?
Ooh, what a good question. Probably in the rain. Probably this blessed rain that's happening right now in Missoula and falling on all the still burning fires. And yeah, I guess that's what I've been paying attention to this morning.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Melissa Kwasny about her book, Where Outside the Body is the Soul Today, her thoughtful collection of poems weaving together the human and natural worlds. What's your definition of the soul?
Oh, I don't know. I wrote a whole book to try to explore that idea. And, you know, I read a lot of people's definitions of it through time, different ways we think about it. Why I was drawn to this subject came from my last book, Pictograph, where I was looking at all these anthropomorphs and zoomorphs that people were painting on rock walls, and often in those paintings, there'll be a crack in the wall, and the images come out from the crack because people have said that there was a belief that the spirits were coming from inside the rock. So I was thinking about that idea of something that lasts beyond death, that it seems like every culture has that idea, and whether they call it the soul or call it something else. It seems most peoples have an idea of something that exists beyond our mortal life and call it the soul. The book's divided into two different parts. One part is just this series of prose poems that have the title Another Letter to the Soul. And those are more discursive. They're letters. They're addressed to the soul. They're in prose poetry form, so they have a more speech-like rhythm to them, a more projective movement. And so those are asking questions about what is it, who is it, where is it, those kind of things. And then the other part are poems that, to myself, I call them the anima poems, because anima is Latin for soul, but it also connects us to the animal and that deeper part of human beings that we share with the animated animals, plants, those kind of things. Seems to me like something that is shared, something that continues beyond individual death. So that whole section, the anima poems, we could also call them people poems because they're the deer people, the Creek people, the blue heron people, because I found that when I was looking for evidence of the soul, I could find it much more easily outside myself than going internally. I think both paths are certainly valid.
Yeah. You've answered my next question, which was about the organizing principles of the book. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you'll just start off by reading one of your anima poems, The Deer People.
Sure. The Deer People. Stumbled under the shade of birds, scratched a little hollow in the dirt and hid the rings there, moved quiet and alone among the others, as if through snow, wearing the sage wristbands. Considered sunshine and its synonyms, considered its antonym, the ebbing tide, spotlit, entered from the wings. Stepped into a spirit world where the natural show themselves, wearing a guise of the same. Disconnected, little dreams, false continuum, often a complete and common shyness. To candle is to examine an egg's freshness by holding it to the light, hole in the ozone, hole in the soul's tallow lining. that grown men can hold their guns to the soft belly of a child, that they can shoot someone who is so afraid. The violence we have allowed to blow through us, a locked bedroom door bucking in its casement. Considered peace and its synonym, the white-tailed doe and her fawn crossed the field of the mind meadow-wise. To ask a question is a promise that one will listen. How the fur is within the fire, wind in the windrow. Saw not particulars, but glow, fed off the nose, cleared the air of all but the smell of clover.
These two sentences, that grown men can hold their guns to the soft belly of a child, that they can shoot someone who is so afraid. When I read that, Melissa, I held my breath, and I am wondering if there's the conversation in this book, but especially in this poem, between, I'm going to use air quotes, like the natural order and the human order.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why we do share. That's why I see our soul as shared outside myself, that anima does, we are animals. Those two lines, every time I read aloud, I almost start crying. And I think about, I think of it both ways. I'm thinking of war. I'm thinking of certainly images of that, of, in this instance, I was thinking particularly of the stories in the Iraqi war. And I was also thinking, of course, about deer, fawns being hunted. It's not really an anti-hunting idea. It's more what happens to our soul. A lot of these poems are, they investigate ideas of the soul, but also ideas of, we use these terms a lot, the wounded soul, the damaged soul, the American soul. Those kind of ideas come in and out of these poems, I think.
I want to circle back around to violence later, but I want to get into the natural world. Your work is known for its stunning and sometimes heartbreaking take on the natural world. And in The Rock People, you write, "Did anyone know to say your life is finite, that here is called earth, that our species was not first or even early, that plants do not bloom for us, but to perpetuate their kind?" And I know that there's a conversation in eco-poetry right now about the division between what is considered human and non-human, and that there's a push towards more interdependence and to desentimentalize nature. Where do you stand in that conversation?
I think we've learned a lot. I think ecological thinking has really, it's gone so much further ahead than in its beginnings when it was less complicated. That, for instance, bad to hunt, good to be a vegetarian, bad to do this, good to do that. And it's gotten much more complex. And I feel like that a big contribution to that is the writing and also thinking from Indigenous people, that those kind of ideas are coming into white consciousness now and are really important for us to try to attempt some kind of healing. And obviously we need some kind of healing because environmental destruction is, I would say, the most crucial, the biggest crises that we have. And everyone is aware of that, whether you believe in global warming or not, but everyone sees that we don't live in the world that our grandparents did or great-grandparents. So if I have a mission as a poet besides just writing poetry, it's as a person to try to understand what is our relationship to the natural world and what are past ideas about that human relationship in poetry, but also in philosophy and social justice work, those kind of things. But also, what are the different paths, not just one path? We have to pool our resources, I think. In this poem, I think what what I was trying to say is we could come into this world with a kind of just a step back and a bigger look. You know, I wish my parents would have said, my parents never sat down and said, okay, your life is finite. This is what the earth is. And other cultures have had that. I think Western culture does not have that big overview. But I thought, what if they did?
That's what, in terms of this sort of white consciousness, is that the reason you invoke Native American or First Nation cultures like Yupik, the Cheyenne, and Dakota?
Mm-hmm. I have learned so much. I think that there's a very real danger of feeling like you're appropriating or stealing from or misrepresenting yourself.
Right.
And I'm really aware of it. I'm scared of it, as I should be.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I have learned more in my life from reading Native writers or from knowing Native people who shared with me certain aspects of their culture and their families. And that's a huge part of my consciousness now. And so I'm trying to give respect in that regard without doing something stupid,
yeah.
Which I probably do sometimes.
Will you read The Rock People?
Sure. Oh, by the way, this idea of the Rock People, one part of it, of naming these, that's some kind of intersection with indigenous thinking in that, you know, the idea of the four-legged people or the two-legged people, those phrases are used from in certain cultures, indigenous cultures. Also, in my book, a couple books earlier in the Nine Senses, I was reading a lot of this Sufi scholar, Henri Corbin, and he had this passage that has always struck with me. And he says, if you want to know what the earth is about, if you want to learn the earth in its aspect as a person, you're asking the wrong questions to say, what is it? That the question should be, who is it? Who are the mountains? Who is the river? Who? And so in these poems, I took that as a challenge of, okay, if I think about the rock as who is the rock? And so it was, I guess, like all poems are, an imaginative exercise for me. So The Rock People. Shut inside the summer house, the rock has disappeared. All glower, the shallow work of leaves. A bower contains the impulse to bow to it, contains a bow which bows also, bent to attention, a string. There is a perfume about it, the perfume of leisure, choke cherry, river birch, red willow, which is not visible, but sensible, entering mind like a thought, thought from minor gods, inflorescences. My parents taught me to work hard, to buy second hand, go for the sale, to bow to money, but also loyalty to family, as in the human psyche made of women turned to stone. Or should I say bone? The dead string our bloodlines. They pause inside the stream. Time, the sense of time. We are set into it by other hands. A second hand for consciousness we name the cursive. The sky is worldly, large and moving, with moving and large clouds. I have been here long, not long enough to have traversed it. Did anyone know to say your life is finite, that here is called Earth, that our species was not first or even early, that plants do not bloom for us but to perpetuate their kind, that miles below our feet an inner fire is burning? But of course, my parents didn't know. Thank you.
You've been listening to Melissa Quasney read From Where Outside the Body Is the Soul Today. This is The Right Question. I'm Sarah Aronson. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. I'm wondering about this speaker in some of these poems. Because in The Cottonwood People, you write, "If I saw my soul, she would be this tree and I would love her." And in The Rock People, I hear a pretty distinct speaker. How much, I guess, of the speaker is you?
I think it varies. I think all me in one sense, in that the speaker is in the working of the poem, that there is a voice that is moving through me, hopefully. Mm-hmm. I feel like that I'm in communication. I know this is going to sound odd to a lot of people, but the intention, the point, is to have some kind of meeting place between the people and myself. And whether you believe that or not doesn't really matter if you're a poet. I mean, whether other people believe it or not, you have to believe if you're going to do any. And I don't mean imaginary act. I mean an imaginal act that you are completely there for. So if I'm writing about the cottonwood, I have to ask permission. Then I have to listen really intently, and sometimes for an hour, sometimes for a month, sometimes, you know, for as long as it takes, and see what comes back to me. Just like we do with a conversation. I have to listen. So hopefully it's both or more voices that are coming through.
I love this idea of the rituals you practice for receptivity, mm-hmm. asking permission and listening. And it's very clear to me that there are so many conversations that happen mm-hmm. in this book, whether it's with another piece of art or a culture or a very particular world. What do you know about your desire for interchange?
I think most poets, probably fiction writers will probably disagree with me on this, but I think most poets, as opposed to fiction writers, are after that moment where another voice takes over. I think that's the thrill of it. It is what imagining is. You're not just working on your own resources, your own inner resources. There's lots of resources out there in the world. And so I think for poetry, the trick over time for me has been to develop my ability to tend to things. Because people say, oh, everyone's born with an imagination, and that's true, but it really has to be practiced and developed, just like playing a violin. And no one's just born being able to do that. And so I think these kind of exercises that you set for yourself, they develop the imagination. And play is the way children develop it. For me, it's more kind of ritualistic, but it's really honing the ear, the physical ear and the psychic ear, yeah. and just paying attention, which also helps me. It's a quieting thing for me also. It's once you attend to someone else, you're less in your own pettiness. It's a nicer way to be.
One of the aphorisms that I read is, from the Creek people, all change is toward healing, though it may look misguided. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you know about that line?
Well, if we believe that the earth, and I always believe if we just quit hurting it, it will heal itself. that if we believe that the direction of the earth is toward healing, is toward making whole, including the fact of death. We also have to recognize that some of that looks pretty pathological. Some of that looks somebody gets cancer, somebody the forest starts on fire. So that it's an old question, but how do we believe in goodness when there's so much badness around us? And just taking it more in terms of natural movements.
You've circled right back around to where I want us to be, which is returning to this violence. In A School for Girls, you wrote this line that I laughed out loud. Hunting season like football season, when men are at their worst.
I know. I think that's the one place that I'm just going to get grief over.
I felt like there's an archetypal conversation there.
I do too, because there is an enjambment there, even with the comma after worse. We have an enjambment over into the next stanza.
Yes.
That says the great mother of the animals. So this is a school I made up. You know, this is what we're teaching there. And so one of the teachers is the great mother of the animals, which is actually, you know, it has been a phrase that cultures have used, not native cultures, but European cultures. And so I, you've heard people say when they can't get an animal, they say, in Montana, they go, all the elk are all hiding under rocks.
Right,
And so I thought that's such a funny phrase. And but what if they really are?
Yeah.
and who would help them do that? Well, the great mother of the animals would do that. So, yeah, it's working. I'm hoping it's working with the next line also.
You know, Melissa, when I think of Melissa Kwasny, probably the last things that come to mind are snowmobiles and football.
And I got them both in there.
And you got them both in there. So what was your instinct behind those things, and what's your relationship to those things?
To football?
Yeah.
I'm just so proud of all those football players taking the knee and everything, but I never watch football. It's everything about it goes against my sensibility.
Right. Which is amazing. It's in this beautiful book.
Yeah. ATVs. I live in the country. I live 3.5 miles up a dirt road in the Elkhorn Mountains. On the weekends, ATVs control the airspace.
Yes.
It's especially during hunting season. And so they're part of my reality. You know, they do say that women are most at risk of being beat up during the Super Bowl, like statistically.
Yeah.
That's so I was just thinking about when are men most dangerous?
Yeah.
And it seems like those two things, I could put war in there, but when that kind of energy is clustered and and then what does the great mother of the animals think of that?
Yeah. What would she say about when men are most vulnerable?
What would she say? I would like to know that too. War might be that too in the aftermath. What would you say?
I don't know, but I'm curious.
Yeah, me too.
There are a lot of questions in your work. And in his book, Triggering Town, Richard Hugo talks about the art of asking questions in writing. And he says, if you ask a question, don't answer it, or answer a question not asked, or defer. If you can answer the question, to ask it is to waste time. Where do your questions come from?
Oh, that's great. That's a wonderful quote. Where do questions come from? I think they come from just this. We do want to know where we are. We want to know who animated beings are. We want to know who, I want to know who you are. I think they come out of clusters of circumstance, of image. they come naturally. I would never ask, I agree with him completely, I would never ask a question that I thought I could answer. Questions just lead you to things, and poems have to keep going, so I think they often appear in my poems somewhere in between, just when I'm at a loss at where I'm going next.
Will you read your last Another Letter to the Soul, the final poem in your book?
Yeah, these are in series, and this is the sixth one in the last section called Another Letter to the Soul. Oh, this is probably apropos for our time, right? Mm-hmm. Welcome, first snow, I speak into the dark. There is the early morning shuffle of its apparel, the slide of buttons as if a coat slipped off. A friend tells me if we could see spirit, it would be this flame blue. I used to think so too, but then I dreamt it. If spirit rises long-tailed, a magpie with iridescent wings, does soul sink back to be melted and molded and made new again? The soul then as under construction. We are in a bed in the upstairs of a house in the making. It is the reading season, no one on the road, the town seeming further away. And the young, are we less interested in what they're doing? Tell me which infinity attracts you, Bachelar writes, and I will know the meaning of your world. I am afraid of the ocean and now fire, and though I would like to know the sky, I am drawn to the infinity that is earth. Rock, its own shape, own meaning, not ours. The weight-bearing, sunburnt character of its slopes.
Melissa Quasney lives in Jefferson City, Montana. Look for more information about her and her book at mtpr.org. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.